So I think, well, I think for this week we can skip the verse memorization due to just to make the timing flow better.
Yeah, I am sorry that I have all these things tomorrow.
Okay, so the devotees who learned a verse for last week, please continue thinking about meditating on that verse for next week. The same one.
Which verse are they learning?
Chapter 13, text 23.
Hmm. We can have everybody say it together. You do that before?
Well, normally each person who learns, they kind of go one by one. Whoever.
Well, why don't we just all say it together? What is
perfect.
It? 13 what?
23. Caesar, can you help me? You can just show these to some people. They can refer to it. People who don't even.
Oh, very nice. Actually, this upadrasta word. Drasta means to see. Upa means above. And Prabhupada's translating overseer. We call in English supervisor. Someone who has supervision. Literally vision. The supervision. So that's very much. Okay, so it's May 29th, 2015 in Long Island, New York. And we're looking today at Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, text 1.
Yes, yes. Okay. And maybe you can help your friend find a page. Can
and
you help can you help them find a page?
Atma? I'm not doing a near job today. Can I get some water?
Oh, is yes, yes. Caesar, can you give me water?
All right, so the Sanskrit here, for those of you who can, those of you who have Sanskrit, maybe you can chant along with me if you can go to chapter 7, text 1. Everybody there? Yes? So if you have a book with the Sanskrit, we can sing it together. Yes, I know this is the same verse that I chose to talk about the other day because I didn't know it would be the verse here. So everybody together? Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Maya Shakta Manaparta Yogam Yunjan Madashraya Asamshayam Samagramam Yatagnashya Sichachchanu. And we can read the English together? The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Now hear, O son of Pritha, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt." Thank you. And I'll just read through Prabhupada's purport. In the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the nature of Krishna consciousness is fully described. Krishna is full in all opulences, and how he manifests such opulences is described herein. Also, 4 kinds of fortunate people who become attached to Krishna and 4 kinds of unfortunate people who never take to Krishna are described in this chapter. So Prabhupada just gave a 1-paragraph summary of this of the upcoming chapter. Now he's going to talk about the previous 6 chapters. One reason he's doing this is that sometimes people say that the Bhagavad Gita is divided into 3 parts, the first 6 chapters, the middle 6 chapters, and the last 6 chapters. So therefore, this is the beginning of the second section. And so Srila Prabhupada in the purport is summarizing the first section. So in the first 6 chapters of Bhagavad Gita, the living entity has been described as non-material spirit soul, capable of elevating himself to self-realization by different types of yogas. At the end of the 6th chapter, it has been clearly stated that the steady concentration of the mind upon Krishna, or in other words, Krishna consciousness, is the higher form of all yoga. By concentrating one's mind upon Krishna, one is able to know the absolute truth completely, but not otherwise. Impersonal Brahmajyoti, or localized Paramatma realization, is not perfect knowledge of the absolute truth because it is partial. By the way, Brahmajyoti, Brahma means spirit and Jyoti means light. Full and scientific knowledge is Krishna, and everything is revealed to the person in Krishna consciousness. So that's an interesting statement. If you're in consciousness of Krishna, everything is revealed. In complete Krishna consciousness, one knows that Krishna is ultimate knowledge beyond any doubts. Different types of yoga are only stepping stones on the path of Krishna consciousness. One who takes directly to Krishna consciousness automatically knows about Brahma Jyotir and Paramatma in full. Paramatma, Atma means the self, Param means supreme. So it means like the Prabhupada usually translates this as the super soul, the super self. the self of all selves, which is very much related to the verse you're just saying from the 13th chapter, that beyond the soul and the body, there's the super seer, the super self who's aware of all bodies. So it's the meaning of Paramatma. Going on, by practice of Krishna consciousness yoga, one can know everything in full, namely the absolute truth, the living entities, the material nature, and their manifestations with paraphernalia. Just a little comment on the use of this word absolute truth. So I've heard some people object and say, oh, this is something sectarian, that you're saying you have the absolute truth and nobody else has the absolute truth. But this is simply another term for God, meaning one who is completely full of truth, one in whom there is no falsity. One should therefore begin yoga practice as directed in the last verse of the 6th chapter. So maybe for those of you who weren't here, we should go back and look at what is this last verse of the 6th chapter. Because Srila Prabhupada is very much connecting this verse, 7.1, with the last verse of the 6th chapter, which the translation is, and of all yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service unto me. He is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So that's the verse to which Srila Prabhupada keeps referring in this purport. So going on with this purport. Concentration of the mind upon Krishna, the Supreme, is made possible by prescribed devotional service in 9 different forms, of which Shravanam, which means hearing, is the first and most important. The Lord therefore says to Arjuna, touch chanu, or hear from me. So this touch chanu is in this verse, 7.1. No one can be a greater authority than Krishna, and therefore by hearing from him, one receives the greatest opportunity to become perfectly Krishna-conscious person. One has therefore to learn from Krishna directly or from a pure devotee of Krishna, and not from a non-devotee upstart puffed up with academic education. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, this process of understanding Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth, is described in the 2nd chapter of the 1st canto as follows. So Srila Prabhupada here is going to quote the Sanskrit and give the translation to a very succinct, concentrated description of what is the process of bhakti yoga. These are very often quoted and important verses from the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is also known as the Bhagavat Purana. This process of the advancement of bhakti yoga is described in similar ways all throughout the sacred literature. So the Sanskrit to these verses is Srinvatam Swakata Krishna Punyashravana Kirtana Vidyantasto Bhadrani Vijunoti Sritsatam Nastaprayashu Abhadreshu Nicham Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavat Uttama Shloke Bhakti Bhavati Naishtaki Tatar Rajas Tato Bhava Kamakrodas Kamalobas Tadataye Cheta Eter Anavidim Stitam Satve Prasidati Evam Prasanna Manaso Bhagavad Bhakti Yogataha Bhagavatatta Vigyana Mukta Sangasya Jayate Vidyate Hridaya Grantis Chidyante Sarvasamshayaha Shidyante Chasti Karmani Drista Evat Manishvare. So the translation of all that is, to hear about Krishna from Vedic literatures or to hear from him directly through the Bhagavad Gita is itself righteous activity. And for one who hears about Lord Krishna, who is dwelling in everyone's heart, acts as the best wishing friend and purifies the devotee who constantly engages in hearing of him. In this way, a devotee naturally develops his dormant transcendental knowledge. As he hears more about Krishna from the Bhagavatam and from the devotees, he becomes fixed in the devotional service of the Lord. By development of devotional service, one becomes free from the modes of passion, ignorance, and thus material lusts and avarice are diminished. When these impurities are wiped away, the candidate remains steady in his position of pure goodness, becomes enlivened by devotional service, and understands the science of God perfectly. Thus, bhakti yoga severs the hard knot of material affection and enables one to come at once to the stage of a samsayam samagram, understanding of the Supreme Absolute Truth, Personality of Godhead. This is from the Bhagavatam 1.2.17.21. Now, the reason Prabhupada here is talking about a samsayam samagram is because those are the words in today's verse, in verse 7. Therefore, only by hearing from Krishna or from his devotee in Krishna consciousness can one understand the science of Krishna. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Maya Shaktamana Parta, Yogam Yinjad Manashraya, Asham Shayam Samagram, Mam, Yat Tagnash Yasi Chachchunu. The Supreme Personality of God had said, "Now hear, O son of Pritha, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt." So this asam sayam samagram, without any doubt, completely. So this is what we are looking for in any process of religion or spirituality. What one should be looking for is to know the truth absolutely without doubt. Now, of course, many people nowadays... Can you all hear me, by the way? Am I speaking loudly enough? Many people nowadays take up religion or philosophy for other reasons. So many people take up religion as a way simply to become happy and prosperous in the world. Right? They're intelligent enough to know that there must be a God, there must be a controller, and you're not going to become happy just simply by getting a degree and getting a good job and having lots of connections in the world and a big house. So they also take up religion to say, "Dear Lord, please give me what I want. Please give me what I want." Something like at Christmas, they bring their list to Santa Claus. Say, "You know, I want this, I want this, I want this. And after death, then let me go even to a better place than this earth." Not difficult to imagine that there are places better than this earth. Let me go there and have even greater enjoyment. So many people take up religion for that purpose, not really to know the truth. They're not particularly interested in knowing the truth. And they take up even religion to become powerful in this life. Many people take up yoga to gain some sort of supernatural powers, mystic powers. So the number of people, this is explained a couple of verses later in the Bhagavad Gita. Manushinam sahasreshu kashchid yadati siddhaya yatatam apisaranam kashchimam veti tatfataha. That out of many, many thousands of people, only a few are going to be really interested in knowing what is going on here. What is the truth? What's the reality? And of all those who are interested, only a few really persevere and want to know what's the real story behind everything. So Krishna's here telling us a very, very simple formula, simple to explain, simple to understand, simple to do externally, very difficult to do internally. So externally, very easy to do. Internally, very difficult to do. The internal process of seeing the truth is not an easy one, though we can talk about it. Something that can really explain it, you know, in half an hour. Hopefully we'll do that. So to see the truth without any doubting, this is a recurrent theme in the Bhagavad Gita. In the fourth chapter, Krishna talked about who is a guru, who is a teacher, is samadarshina, tattva darshina, someone who has seen, tattva again means truth, darshina to see, someone who has seen the truth. A little later in the ninth chapter, he talks about praktyaksha bhagamam dharmam, to directly experience, aksha means eyes, practice right in front of one's eyes. The truth is obvious. I'm assuming everyone here already wants to know truth. Do I need to convince anybody that we need to know the truth? Or is everybody already here for that purpose? We know there's something funny here in this world, yes? Something's not right. Have you noticed that? Something's not quite right. If you do everything that the materialistic people tell you to do, you don't achieve the success that they promised you. It doesn't work. You know, you go to the best schools, you get good grades, you get a very good job, a beautiful home, you know, a flat screen TV, the latest smartphone. Oh, which reminds me, I should turn my phone to vibrate. You have good friends, whatever. And still you have all of that, and you say at the end, "Is that all there is?" Isn't it? Yes? You've experienced that? You get something and then it's like, that's it? That's what everybody was talking about? You know, I do this thing that's supposed to make me happy, it's supposed to make me satisfied, and it sort of doesn't, really? So an intelligent person will say, what's going on here? What's happening? Things are obviously not what they seem. There is a difference between the way things appear and my actual experience of them. It looks like, I'll get happiness by doing that, but when you get it, it's not what you thought it was. So an intelligent person wants to know, what's the truth? What's really going on? What's the reality? Can I see beyond this veil of illusion? And we want to see this for ourselves. We want to see this for ourselves. This is not a question when Krishna says beyond doubt. He's talking about faith. He's not talking about blind faith. Already in the fourth chapter, we talked about this yesterday, 434, where Krishna makes it very clear one should not have blind faith. That one should go to people who are experiencing the truth, and then in 435 again he says one should oneself experience the truth. And Srila Prabhupada commenting on it says blind faith is condemned. So we're not really interested in some sort of religion or philosophy where you're just told to believe because you're told to believe. Why should you believe? Because you just should. Because this is the religion of your parents and the religion of your society, and you're just told, believe, believe, believe. And when will you see the proof of your belief? When you die. Well, then it's a little late, isn't it? Right? If you know, you should be able to see it now. If it's true, it should be something you should be able to experience, at least to some extent, at the present. And this is how one comes beyond doubt. So in education, we learn if you want to have people believe something, you basically have two choices. One is an external authority and one is their internal authority. So one is somebody external to them who they trust says, yes, this is true. I mean, there's many things that's our only way to believe it. If somebody says it's 93 million miles to the sun, how are we going to check this? You know, we're not going to take a ruler and measure it ourselves. We just have to believe that authority or not believe that authority. And many people choose not to believe their authorities. Isn't that a fact? You know, the government says this is what happened. Oh, the government's lying. How are you going to check it out for yourself? Very difficult. But the other kind of authority is within. I have my own personal experience of something. And that's the ultimate convincer, isn't it? No matter what anybody says and no matter how much I trust anybody else, I'm not going to be ultimately convinced about something unless I personally experience it. And this is the way that Krishna is saying to come without any doubting, that one sees the truth for oneself, that one experiences the truth. Now, what are the symptoms of having experienced the truth? And this is throughout the Bhagavad Gita. This question is asked, I hope many of you know, the Bhagavad Gita is a discussion between Krishna and Arjuna. And Arjuna asked this question, how do I know what are the symptoms? But am I speaking slowly enough for you?
Okay. Okay.
You can understand? Okay. If you don't understand something, just tell me and I'll slow down a little more. So Arjuna asked throughout the Bhagavad Gita, how can we tell? What are the symptoms of somebody who is self-realized, who's seeing the truth? And in several places, specifically 2nd chapter, 12th chapter, 14th chapter, but in various other verses, Krishna gives some symptoms so that we can gauge for ourselves, that we can gauge for a teacher that we're going to and that we can gauge for ourselves. Am I experiencing truth? Am I experiencing truth? So does anyone know some of the prime symptoms given in Bhagavad Gita?
Equipoise.
To be equipoised. This is got to be one of the top ones. It's repeated over and over and over as one of the main symptoms of experiencing the truth. That when you experience the truth, you're not affected by the changes in the illusion. And we could compare this to, I give this example many times, if you go into a shop where they're selling television sets, and on the television sets, they're showing something in order to show you the quality of the television set. They're playing some movie or some show, correct? Right? Everybody has seen this? And on the show, you know, somebody's laughing, somebody's crying, somebody's getting killed, somebody's getting married. Isn't that correct? Yes? But you're walking through the store and you're not watching the show. Therefore, as you're walking through the store, you're not affected. So you see on one screen somebody's dying, another screen somebody's getting married, but there's no emotional response from you. Whereas if you were watching the show and you were absorbed in the show, you would have an emotional response. Is this clear to everybody? Right. So when one sees the truth, one understands that what we are experiencing in this world is not really happening to us. And Krishna explains this in the 5th and in the 13th chapter. We are just the observer. We are just the observer. What is happening in this world is happening to the body and mind, which is not me. I am not really doing or experiencing what is here. I am just the observer. Exactly like a person watching a film is an observer and experiences emotionally the film only if they allow themselves to become absorbed in it. And if they don't allow themselves to become absorbed in it, it doesn't touch them emotionally. And really, whatever is in the film, it is, number one, not really happening. And number two, certainly not really happening to oneself. Or the example given mostly in the scriptures, because at that time there wasn't cinema, was that of a dream. So in a dream, we're experiencing some emotional reaction. But the dream's not really happening. I mean, something's happening. Like in the movie, something's happening. It's not like Buddhists where they say nothing's happening. But it's not what's happening is not what appears to be happening. So when one sees the truth, when one is established in truth, one naturally, as a byproduct, becomes equipoised to the ups and downs of this world. Because one sees it, it really has nothing to do with me whatsoever. And I am not really experiencing these things. One frees oneself from attachment to the illusion because one becomes attached to the truth. And there's a whole list of things repeated throughout the Bhagavad Gita of what one becomes equipoised about. Anyone can tell me some of these things one becomes equipoised about? Yeah?
Happiness and distress.
Happiness and distress. Some others?
Death and lamentation.
Lamentation, yes.
Honor and dishonor.
Honor and dishonor. Yeah.
Friends and enemies.
Friends, enemies, and neutral parties.
Heat and cold.
It's important to know this because these are the symptoms whether or not I'm seeing truth. Otherwise, I can say, you know, some people don't say, I am a Christian, Muslim, Jew, Buddhist, Hindu, whatever, and I am in truth. Well, if you're in truth, there'll be these symptoms. It's just like if someone says, I have good health. There's tests you can take, right? You go to a doctor and they give you tests to see if you're in good health or not. You know, I was recently traveling with my teenage grandson and he was very, very tired. He was like so tired. He didn't want to wake up in the morning. Why am I so tired? He says. And then he's sneezing and coughing. And I said, well, that's why you're tired. You have a cold. He says, I don't have a cold. So I said, well, it's obvious you have a cold. You're blowing your nose every 10 minutes. So a person can say, I am healthy, but there's symptoms of health. Yes? So if someone says, I am in truth, it doesn't mean that just you subscribe to a particular set of beliefs and you practice a certain rituals. But if you're situated in truth, you will love your enemies. You will equally love your friends and enemies. That doesn't mean you necessarily bring your enemies in for, you know, tea and biscuits. But you wish well to everybody. You don't wish well only to those who wish well to you. And the happiness and distress of the body and the mind, fame and infamy, honor and dishonor, heat and cold, auspicious and inauspicious, these things don't affect you emotionally. You remain steady in all of them. What's some other symptoms besides equanimity of someone who has seen the truth? Oh, also another kind of equanimity, not only to friends and enemies, but to different kinds of bodies. So in the 5th chapter, Krishna says, Vidyavanaya sampane brahmani gavi hastani suni chai vasvapakeja pandita samadarshina. That somebody who's really in the truth, they don't really see this is a dog, this is an elephant, this is a bum in the street, this is a learned scholar. They see here's a soul in everyone. Now this, we find an attempt to artificially imitate this in our modern society. You know, don't see anybody according to their gender, their race, their ethnicity, their level of poverty. And we teach this, but we find, we have to just say frankly, the people are not able to practice it. That although there's such an emphasis on equality, still there's discrimination, there's racism. Yes, isn't it? Right? How much do we preach equality in this country? America is one of the most egalitarian cultures in the world. We're surpassed by Australia and Brazil. Probably a few other places as well. But we're really high up there as far as a country that preaches egalitarianism. We preach it in the schools and the media and so forth. But do we have problems with entrenched discrimination in this country, don't we? I mean, there's all these studies that if you apply for a job with the name... Yes? Something you don't understand?
Well, you know, everything is the truth.
Yes.
And for us to be here, we need a lot of everything.
Yes.
We step in every place.
Yes.
If we connect with ideas, every ideas coming to us, we see the ideas.
Yes.
We just pick it up what we need. And if we fall down road, is always beautiful, no?
Yes. That is another nice element of being situated in the truth. So we talked about being equipoise, seeing everyone equally. Actually seeing everyone equally.
Is the way supposed the every teacher teach that? Jesus said we are brothers.
Undoubtedly. Anyone who says we have a monopoly on truth, right there you can understand that they're cheating. So we don't say in the Hare Krishna movement, at least we shouldn't say, maybe we have some members who say this, but we shouldn't be saying. Our founder, Srila Prabhupada, didn't say it. That we have a monopoly on truth. How can you have a monopoly on truth? It's like saying we have a monopoly on mathematics.
But you don't see the truth? People don't see the truth?
No, generally they don't.
Why?
Oh, we'll get to that. Give me a minute. We'll get to that.
No.
We'll get there.
Wait a minute. Wait.
You want me to get there now? But I'm getting there. Don't worry. Just hold on. Just.
But is the truth?
Yes.
The truth is the truth.
But whether or not you can see the truth depends on various factors. Just because it's obvious to one who's seen it, but to others it's not obvious. So let me get there. Can you give me a minute? Is that all right?
Just one thing.
Yes.
You have ears to hear, eyes to see. It's just that.
You're right. But there's a little trick to it also. So that we'll get to. So let's just go through symptoms and then we'll get to how. Is that okay? Can you stay with me?
Yes.
Okay. So we have a symptom of being equipoised. We have a symptom of actually seeing equally, not seeing according to the body. Then we have, you talked about seeing that everything is beautiful. So this is a seeing that everything is glorious and beautiful, basically being in a state of joy. That people who see the illusion, who are seeing friends and enemies, they're seeing, oh, this person is against me, everything is very dangerous, I have to protect myself, whereas somebody in truth sees, I am an eternal being, I've always existed in the past and in the future, I cannot be hurt by anyone, there's a divine plan behind everything, everything is perfect, and they see beauty and harmony everywhere. Yes, did you want to say something?
Yeah, well, we are talking about being and I was thinking about Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and in his pastimes, all the times when he's swooning in ecstasy, when he's thinking about Lord Jagannath or for Lord Jagannath. So I wonder how that fits in.
Oh, that's a very good question. So what you're talking about is a very high level of truth. So, all right, we'll go there. Wasn't planning on going there now, but we'll go there now, and we'll get to your points, Krishna. So there are many philosophies in yogas. Prabhupada talks in this purport about different kinds of yogas that culminate in Krishna consciousness. And yoga means a system of connecting. So basically, again, any religion, any genuine religion, there's false religions also, but any genuine religion or any genuine philosophy is going to be one that connects us to the truth. and relieves us of illusion. So these can be categorized as what we call karma yoga, gyan yoga, dhyan yoga, and bhakti yoga, or some combinations of these. Karma yoga is you connect with truth by being a good person in the world, a responsible good person, and dedicating everything for the pleasure of the Lord or for your personal salvation, instead of dedicating everything to enjoy the world. So you have a job, but you have a job to purify yourself for enlightenment rather than just to make money and enjoy the world. You take care of your family, not because you want to enjoy a happy family, but because by doing so, it will help you to become enlightened. Then there's Gyan Yoga, where you study the nature of the world. You study that the body is temporary. You study that material endeavors are temporary and futile. You study the nature of the truth. And by intellectual conviction, you come to the point of realization of the Brahmajyoti, the unlimited, undifferentiated light. Then there's Jnana Yoga. Jnana Yoga is very difficult to perform, because in order to perform Jnana Yoga or meditative yoga, one has to already be very purified. In Jnana Yoga, which is also called Astanga Yoga, you are also engaged in pious activities. You situate your body in certain postures, you breathe in a certain way, and by doing that mechanically, you kick your consciousness into a realization of the supreme within the heart in a mechanical way. And then there's bhakti, where you link with the supreme through love and devotion. And we don't have time tonight, but we could analyze all of the great teachers of the world. They're all teaching some of these forms of yoga or some combination of them. Now, generally, in karma yoga, gyan yoga, and dhyan yoga, what they're trying to do is first stop material illusion and affection and come to this platform of equanimity. Now, for some, coming to this platform of equanimity is the goal. They don't aspire beyond that. But for some, after taking everything down on the material platform and coming to equanimity, they then want to rise with love on the spiritual platform. Now, this is something like if you have a cup of chemical juice. Yes, everybody knows what I mean by that? Water with some flavor and artificial flavor, usually artificial color, maybe even artificial Kool-Aid. Sugar, like Kool-Aid, yeah. But they sell this everywhere in different names. You know, you can buy a big gallon of it for like a dollar or something. You know, and it is this artificial color, artificial flavor, maybe artificial sweetener. Maybe it's got 1% fruit juice. So you have your cup full of this stuff. In karma yoga, gyan yoga, and dhyan yoga, you empty it out, you get an empty cup. You try to just become empty, and in sometimes they will say, now fill your cup up with spirituality. Now in bhakti yoga, it's not like that. In bhakti yoga, we say, you fill yourself with spirituality, and as you do, the material illusions proportionally diminish. So the science of bhakti yoga is you have a cup full of chemical juice, and you start pouring in that fresh orange juice from the oranges picked from the tree in your backyard. And as you pour that in, you start getting a percentage becomes real, and eventually the whole thing becomes real. Now, the supposition here is that beyond the illusion of our happiness and distress and our hankering and lamenting and our joy and our grief, there is a reality of those things. So many yogas assume that beyond those there is nothing. There is simply an equanimity. But bhakti yoga says beyond those there are emotions and there are desires, which are the reality of which the material emotions are an illusion. And this is actually hinted at in today's verse with Maya Shaktamana Partha. So hold that for 1 second and we'll get to it in about 2 or 3 minutes. All right, so if we want to come to this experience of truth ourselves, especially if we want to come to this experience of truth, that is the reality of which this world is a reflection, not just the equanimity. So Krishna is giving us several ways here of doing that. He's giving us several steps. He says, Maya Shakta Manaparta. He says, Mad Ashraya and Tach Chanu. So he's basically giving three things to do to experience the truth oneself without doubt. So this Chach Chanu, just here, is something that Srila Prabhupada talks about a lot in this purport. that you hear about the absolute truth from Krishna himself or from those who are already realized. And this is a very important part of bhakti yoga. Not here to gather information like you would study for a test on, you know, world history. So you can just repeat back, you know, this was the date of the Battle of Hastings and this is, you know, the date of the American Revolution or something like that. But to hear with affection and attention so that, as explained very nicely in this purport, Trinvitam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtanai Riddhan Tasto Bhadranis Vijinoti Saritsita, that the illusion in the heart becomes cleansed just by hearing. And the reason for that is that when one hears about the truth, it starts to attract one. It starts to awaken in one some desire and some attraction. And one should be hearing about Krishna and hearing this philosophy for that purpose, not hearing to gather knowledge. So this ties into what you're bringing out, that you're hearing to evoke emotion. The reason that we become detached from the happiness and distress and the joy and the grief and the heat and the cold of this world. Please try to understand this, because this is really the essential thing that differentiates bhakti yoga from all other kinds of yoga. The way we become detached from those things is we become attached to the real things. There is a real happiness and distress, and there's a real hankering and lamentation, which is all full of happiness. How could lamentation be full of happiness? Well, how could people enjoy sad movies? They do, yes? Yes? Do people pay money to see sad movies? Was it a good movie? Oh, it was great. So there's a spiritual reality of which this world is a reflection. And in bhakti, as one hears about Krishna, one starts relishing the reality and in that way becomes equipoise to the reflection. Again, if you're walking through this shop, maybe the reason you're not involved with what's on the monitors is you're walking through the shop with someone you love and you're absorbed in your relationship with that person. And therefore, you have no need of becoming attached to simply what some actors are doing. If you have an orange tree in your backyard, you're probably not going to buy false orange juice at the shop. It's just not going to attract you. I used to have a garden for about 10 years. And when you grow your own vegetables and your own fruits, there's no way you buy stuff from the supermarket. It's just not at all attractive. You pick your own tomatoes and you go to the shop and the tomatoes, there's no flavor in them. So when we hear about Krishna, when we hear about the spiritual world, we get that experience. And then Maya Shakta Mana Partha. So this also Prabhupada talks about a lot in this purport. Mana. Mana means the mind. To absorb the mind in Krishna. And this is a continuing theme of the Bhagavad Gita. And we could say that this is really the essence of all kinds of yoga. Karma yoga, Jnana yoga, Dhyana yoga. That one absorbs one's mind in truth. Because it is really the mind that determines who we are, where we go. This is nicely explained in the 8th chapter, that the whole essence of reincarnation is what am I thinking about? What do I desire? What do I want? Now, how mind? The mind has three components, thinking, feeling, willing. And Krishna is saying here to absorb the mind in a shakti. A shakti means attachment. Well, attachment? We're just talking about if you know the truth, you're going to be detached. So again, the idea is to be detached through attachment to the real, not just to be detached. If one is just detached, what is the difference then between us and, you know, the floor? The floor is also detached. The floor doesn't care about happiness and distress and heat and cold and honor and dishonor. So we're not aiming for that. I mean, there are some philosophers in the world who teach that we are aiming for that, that we want to become like nothing. And we want to lose our sense of self. But Krishna here is saying, become established in truth by being attached to the truth. When you become attached to the truth, you will become detached from the illusion. And it is This, among other things, which is one reason why it is so hard for people to see and hear the truth, even though it is all around them. I'm sure sometimes you've been in a situation with somebody that you loved very much, and the person was angry at you without really justifiable cause. Has this happened to all of you? Right? You really didn't do anything wrong. And that you really care about that person. And that person is upset with you because they are misinterpreting something. Has everyone had this experience? You did something, you said something, and they are interpreting it in a way different from your intentions and maybe different even from what happened. But sometimes the person is so absorbed in their story about what happened that there's nothing you can do to get them to see what actually happened. Yes, we've all experienced this. They're so set in that. And maybe we've also done that. You know, maybe we've also done that. And maybe, you know, hours or years later, we come to see, wait a minute, I was telling myself the wrong story. This person really did something quite different. They really had very different intentions. I mean, all over the world, there are people imprisoned wrongly because somebody believed the wrong story about the facts. Happens all the time. So it's difficult to absorb our mind in the truth when we are telling ourselves the wrong story about illusion. And we can become very invested in our stories about illusion, such that no matter what truth is presented to us, we simply don't see it. We simply don't hear it. So Prabhupada explains here in this purport that the processes of bhakti are meant to bring us to this point of attachment. They are meant to soften our heart so that we become receptive to what's already around us. I mean, I'm going to speak very bluntly here, and hopefully I don't offend anyone. The reason that we're very invested in our false stories, which prevent us from seeing the truth, is entirely and completely because it feeds our false ego. That I am a very important person in the world, and the world is about me, and I am the center, and everything's about my happiness. It's that investment, which most of us don't believe we have that. We may see that in other people, but generally we don't believe that we also feel that way. Most human beings on the planet believe that they're very kind and selfless and caring and giving, and that they don't have this sort of self-centered view of reality. But the unfortunate fact is that most of us do have a self-centered view of reality, and we tell ourselves stories about the world to nourish and bolster that very view. And we become very invested in these. And therefore, it's hard for us to become attached to the truth. We hold on to our attachments of illusion. So Krishna is saying, become attached to the truth. And I find it very significant that in bhakti yoga, we are not so much about detach yourself from illusion as we are about attach yourself to truth. In other processes, they're much more about detach yourself from illusion. That is very, very difficult. Possible, but difficult. And here Krishna is saying, you want to know the truth? Start becoming attached to the truth. Now, what makes that somewhat easy is that the truth is very attractive and very tasty. It is very satisfying. Yadyatma supersedeti. Because one of the symptoms of being in truth is that one feels boundless happiness. And even to feel that for a moment, it is such an amazing experience that one will want more and more and more of it. Therefore, I don't know if I should tell you this either, but once you start on this path of truth, and once you've tasted it once, it is very difficult, almost impossible, to go back to being a materialistic person. And this is I probably shouldn't tell you that, but once you take that step, you really can't go back completely. I mean, you can if you really, 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 really want to, but it's almost impossible. You know, once you've had fresh squeezed orange juice from the oranges in your backyard, you know that chemical juice is just never going to taste the same anymore. You're going to know what the reality is. You're going to say, wait a minute, I know what real orange juice is. So it's easy, in one sense, it's easy to become attached to the truth because it's so tasty. In another sense, it's difficult because we have so much invested in falsity. It's kind of like if you own the chemical juice factory. It's where you're making your profit. You know, then however much tasty the real juice is, you're not going to want to admit it. Like the people in the tobacco companies, you know, they don't want to admit that they're making something that kills people. Right? You remember all those lawsuits? No. Our product doesn't kill anybody because they're invested in it. So this is the dichotomy. Very easy because it's very attractive, and very difficult because I have this investment. And what's attractive is this reality of emotion. That's what's attractive. That in the spiritual reality, in the absolute truth, all of the things that we seek to enjoy here and become more or less frustrated with trying to enjoy here has its counterpart, has its original thing. And that's what makes it so attractive. And then I wanted to spend the rest of the time talking about mud ashraya. Ashraya means shelter. So to hear about Krishna, to get some attachment, desire, emotion, attraction to the truth, and to take shelter of the truth. Now, this again is very easy to understand, but not so easy to do. Not so easy to do, again, because of our investment in illusion. So this shelter of the truth can be understood, and this is just a very brief summary. It can be understood in six categories. The six categories of surrender. This is another recurring theme throughout the Bhagavad Gita, that our relationship with the truth is to be under the shelter of the truth, to be surrendered to the truth. In illusion, we think, you know, I don't have to surrender to anybody. I am my own boss. I am independent. Which is obviously not true. We're dependent on air. We're dependent on temperature, we're dependent on water, we're dependent on food, we're dependent on so many things. We cannot be an independent shelter. We have to take shelter of so many things. We have to surrender to so many things. We're surrendering to our body. I mean, to how long can you go without sleep? How long can you go without using the toilet? I mean, there's a limit at which we just have to say, yes, 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 okay, I'll do whatever you say. So that's the reality, is that we are small and dependent. So Krishna is saying here, instead of being dependent on the illusion, become dependent on the reality. And this again is something internally we have some resistance to this, because we are thinking, wait a minute, I don't want to depend on anyone. But one cannot experience the truth unless one's living in the truth. So this mud ashraya is very much about living in the truth. And I think that if we look at the rituals and the formulas of practically any religion, we'll find that there's at least an attempt to do this. That's at least the basis, the driving force, the original function, whatever it may morph into over time. So again, this is understood in six categories. The first is to accept anything that's favorable to love of God. So this is, again, things like hearing about Krishna, talking about Krishna, remembering him, serving him, being with other people who are practicing spiritual life, going to holy places, setting up a sacred space in your home, becoming friends with the Lord, trusting Krishna, acting in such a way that he will trust you, taking up processes of meditation and chanting, offering one's food to the Lord. These are all things that one accepts. And then the next thing is to reject anything that's unfavorable. So Srila Prabhupada has given us particularly four things he said that we should reject. So illicit sex, intoxication, eating of meat, fish, and eggs, and gambling. That these four things particularly cover us with ignorance. And when one is engaged in these things, one cannot see truth. And we could talk about each of them for at least an hour, and why that is the case, that each of these keep us from the truth. Now, not only these things, illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling, but especially in the 16th chapter, Krishna says, Trividam narakasyedam dwaranashanam atmana kamakrodas tatalobas tasmadeta twayam twajet, which very much relates to the verses that Prabhupada is quoting here, where he says, tata rajas tamobhava kama loba dayaschaye. And he talks about stitam sattve prasidati. So one should particularly give up lust, anger, and greed, things that pull us down into ignorance, things that cover our knowledge. And there's a whole explanation which, you know, again, we don't have time to really get into it in depth, but as you go in the Bhagavad Gita and study the modes of goodness, passion, ignorance, and Krishna gives a detailed explanation. He gives a general explanation in chapter 14 and a detailed explanation in chapters 17 and 18 of what kind of activities, food, charity, sacrifices, vision, knowledge, etc., are in goodness, in passion, and in ignorance. And one should give up these things that are in passion or in ignorance. As a super brief summary, the mode of ignorance is about, I want to get my enjoyment external to myself. Enjoyment is about pleasing my senses and mind. And I don't really care how I do it. I want it now. I want it right now. And I don't really care whether what I'm doing is good for me, good for the planet, good for anybody else. I don't care about the consequences. I just want my happiness now, in whatever way possible. And happiness in the mode of passion is, I define my happiness as pleasure for my mind and senses, but I want to do it in a good way. I want to do it in a way that's very socially acceptable. I want to do it in a way that will bring me praise and honor from the society. I want to do something that will help the society. I'm willing to work hard. I don't necessarily want my happiness immediately. I'm willing to defer it and work hard to get it. But my happiness is still external of the body and the mind. Then happiness in the mode of goodness is my happiness I want particularly from my mind and my emotions. And I want to get that happiness internally by being in harmony with the world and in harmony with nature. I want to be a good person, not because other people will praise me and I'll be able to get things in the world, but I want to be a good person just because I will feel good inside. Someone in the mode of passion wants to be forgiving, so everybody will say, oh, how wonderful and forgiving you are. And a person in the mode of goodness wants to be forgiving because it feels good to be forgiven. So these are the modes of nature. So what one should give up is especially anything in passion and ignorance. One should take only those things that are in goodness. So that's accepting what's favorable and rejecting what's unfavorable. Then it's seeing that Krishna is my maintainer, because Krishna is my maintainer. We cannot produce water. If it doesn't rain, we don't get water. We cannot artificially produce food. You know, when I was little, I used to watch Star Trek on television, and they were artificially producing food in the... The computer was synthesizing food on the spaceship. But you can't do that. You have to get food from sunlight, right? I was in Manhattan yesterday, and we have one of our devotees runs a restaurant there. So I stopped by, and I was getting something to eat. And one gentleman came, and he said, is it all right if I sit in the seat next to you? I'll block your view of the street. He was a very big guy. And I said, yeah, sure. He said, I have to sit here because I have to, there's a plug here and I have to recharge my phone. So I was eating an apple and I said, oh. I said, well, my apple doesn't need to be charged. And he said, oh, you have an iPhone? I said, no, I have an actual apple. So he said, oh, we forget that there is an actual apple. I said, yeah. And then he went to get something to eat and he comes back and I said, you know, my apple runs on solar power. He said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, what is this apple? It's a transformation of sunlight. Right? The sunlight. And he says, oh, yeah, photosynthesis. I learned that in school. I'm like, yeah. So the sunlight is transformed into the apple, and the apple is transformed into my skin and my hair and so many things. So Krishna is our maintainer. He's maintaining us by giving us water, by giving us air, by giving us heat. We're going to talk about this a little bit more tomorrow night. So certainly Krishna is maintaining me. It's not really that I can maintain myself just by my hard work and my intelligence. Otherwise, everyone who worked hard would be a millionaire. You know, it's not like that. Working hard doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get water. It doesn't mean you're going to get food and so many things. So Krishna is my only maintainer. You know, I do my work out of duty and as an offering. but I am maintained by Krishna. And Krishna is my protector. There's a nice saying, Mari Krishna Rake Ke, Rake Krishna Mari Ke. Krishna wants to save you, no one can kill you. Krishna wants to kill you, no one can save you. That although we take normal efforts to protect ourselves, we wear clothing for the weather, and, you know, we have a structure that keeps the rain out and so many things, and we keep our money in a safe place, still only Krishna can protect whatever I have. And if Krishna wants to take away, then he takes away. Prabhupada says, like, Krishna has 10 hands. If he wants to give you, you can't, with his 10 hands, you can't even receive all of it. There's so much abundance. And if he wants to take away, you can't hold on to it. So let the Lord maintain me as he wants. That's the third one. And the fourth one is let him protect me as he wants. And the fourth one is to recognize that I'm not independent in fulfilling my desires. So nitya nityanam chaitanis chaitanam eko bahunam yo vidadati kama. That the one eternal among all the eternals is supplying all of our desires. So there's been a movement in the past few years, this idea that whatever desire you meditate on, the universe will give you. That's true, although it's only partially true. It's not a complete truth. It's not necessarily that Krishna just gives it to you immediately. He may give you the knowledge how to attain it through the law of karma. But at least they understand the principle that we're not independent in fulfilling our desires. I cannot just manifest my desires. There has to be the permission from Krishna. So this is another shelter of Krishna. And finally, that one is very humble. Humility is sometimes not well understood. Humility may be misunderstood as low self-esteem or self-effacement. But humility is simply honesty, that within the universal schemes of things, I'm not very important from a material perspective. I'm important from the perspective of love. Just like so many people at every moment are being born and dying on the earth, and in the whole universal scheme of things, none of those people are very important. But to the mother of the child who's being born or who's dying, that person is very important. So in the sense of love, we are very important to Krishna. We are unique. We have a unique relationship with Krishna. But other than that, we really don't have very much importance, nor do we have very much power. So our importance, our power, our meaning, our significance is in terms of a loving relationship. That is our reality. And we don't have a lot of meaning, value, significance, and importance, etc., outside of that loving relationship, on our own power. So these are the 6 symptoms of Madashraya. And cultivating of these also allows one to see the Absolute without doubting. So to experience the Absolute without doubting, we absorb ourselves in hearing with emotion and desire. And we absorb our mind in the truth, again, with spiritual attachment. And we take up these 6 ways of taking shelter of the Absolute Truth by accepting what's favorable, rejecting what's unfavorable, recognizing that Krishna is the maintainer, recognizing that Krishna is the protector, recognizing that I'm not independent in fulfilling my desires, and recognizing my true position, my authentic position as significant and important within my relationship with the Absolute, and very insignificant outside of that relationship with the Absolute. And one who lives this way starts to experience the truth for themselves. And we should end with saying it's not an on-off switch. It's not either I'm totally in illusion or I'm totally in the light. It's a gradual process. It's something like the sun rising in the morning. That even when the sun's below the horizon, when it starts to rise, right, you start seeing silhouettes, correct? Right? There's enough light just for the rods in the eyes, which don't see color. And you start seeing everything just as black and white shapes. But you can see enough to function. And as the sun rises more, gradually you can see more and more until the noontime. Or something like waking up in the morning. You know, you first wake up and it's You don't generally go from fast asleep to fully awake instantly. Usually it's a gradual process of waking up. So generally coming to see the truth is a gradual process. The reason it is a gradual process, it doesn't have to be a gradual process, but the reason it's a gradual process is because, unfortunately, most of us have a lot invested in illusion, and we are only willing to give up that investment gradually. That is what makes it gradual. If we were willing to give up that investment immediately, it would not have to be a gradual process. So it is as gradual as we want to make it. But the reality for most of us is we're so heavily invested in illusion that it is a bit of a process. So thank you very much. I hope this was helpful. We have some time for questions or no?
Yes.
Okay.
So people can ask questions.
Whatever you'd like. Yes.
Am I correct in understanding that you mentioned that if you don't follow the regulative principles, then you can't experience a relationship with Krishna?
Well, again, it's not an on-off switch. It's not like that. Whatever you do, that you gain benefit from. But a full relationship with Krishna would be very difficult. Be very difficult. How are you going to... I mean, let's just look at each of them. So if you're eating meat, fish, and eggs, then you're maintaining your body through a process of extreme violence. How are you going to contact the absolute truth, which is loving and merciful, if you don't have mercy? You can to some extent, but you're going to reach a limit. You're going to reach a ceiling. Does that make sense? And gambling means I'm trying to make money dishonestly. We're supposed to make money by an honest exchange of goods or services. So when you're making money with gambling, what are you doing? What are you giving to the, you know? If you sit with your friends, everybody puts in a dollar, and whoever wins gets all $10. What are you giving to your friends with whom, or whoever you're gambling with, in exchange for the dollar they're putting in? You're giving them nothing. You're not giving them anything that's worth a dollar. You're giving them the promise that maybe they can cheat you. It's not an honest way of making a living. And how can one be in touch with the complete honesty, the complete truth, unless one is truthful? And then intoxication. So intoxication puts you in more illusion. I'm not sure what the percentage is, but I wouldn't be surprised if like 80% of crimes are involved with some form of intoxication. I mean, it's big. People who commit crimes are often under the influence of some sort of intoxicant. And intoxication means you have another cloud. How can you see truth when you're clouding your consciousness? It doesn't make sense. And illicit sex means that I'm taking sexual enjoyment from somebody without really giving them anything in return. So sex is supposed to be done only when there's some sacrifice, some giving, and some commitment. And this is the idea of marriage. I don't know. Marriage is not so popular anymore. Although it's still more popular here than in Northern Europe, but it's not very popular anymore. Even when people get married, they don't really mean it, at least half the time. But the idea is, okay, if I want to enjoy sexual pleasure from you, I'm giving you myself in exchange. There's some kind of sacrifice. And there's supposed to be a sacrifice also that along with sexual pleasure we produce good children. This is also not a very popular stance in the modern day. Sex is about children? No, sex is about pleasure. Well, if we want to live honestly in harmony, you know, we want to live in harmony with nature, we want to live in balance ecologically. Well, guess what? If you live in harmony with nature, then sex is about children. Sorry, I know that's not very popular. But it's exactly like food is not something you put in your mouth that tastes good. Food is something that nourishes your body. That's the function of food. That's the definition of food. And you think, well, if I put in something that nourishes my body, it also has calories. So, you know, I want to enjoy the taste of food, but I don't want the calories. So let me eat something that has the taste but no calories. Well, then guess what? You become sick. from all this food that looks something like food and tastes something like food but isn't real food. And frankly, the same with the sexual function of the body. It's meant, that's the idea, is it's meant to produce good population. Not just to produce children, but to produce good children. So that's the payment. The payment for sexual pleasure is you take care of your sexual partner lifelong, and you produce good children for the society. And if one has sexual pleasure without that, then how are you going to be in harmony with God and the truth? That's how he created things. You know, the whether for men and or women, I think it's a little stronger for women, but it's also there for men. As soon as you have sex with someone, there's an emotional bond with that person. I mean, there's now scientific evidence that as soon as you have sex with someone, part of that person's DNA goes into your body and stays there for the rest of your life. You have a bond with that person. So if one wants to see the truth, then one has to use the body in truth. Using sex in another way is using it falsely. So how can you say, I want to see truth, and my most near and dear possession, my own body, I'm using in a way that's not in harmony with truth? Again, you can understand something, but you'll reach a limit, because your life will be out of sync with what you say you're trying to do. So this, again, is not a very popular position. Something I try not to talk about for the first time somebody comes, because it runs so counter to the modern. I'd say of all of the things that we are teaching in the Hare Krishna movement, this one is the most counter to the modern way of life. It's the most difficult for people to accept. So I try to not push it very much. Is that all right? But even if you follow those things, you know, if you're nasty to people and you're angry and greedy and you're sectarian and you're cruel, you're not going to understand Krishna either. And none of those things are not spiritual in and of themselves. They basically set the ground. Is that okay? Does that make some sense? And those are not the only things. Again, you know, can't lie and cheat and steal. Can't murder people. Well, that wasn't listed. It's not meat, fish. I'm a vegetarian, but I'd murder people. It's not. Can't do that. Yes.
What did Krishna say about chakras?
You know, he does say something about the chakras in the 8th chapter, particularly, also mostly in the 8th chapter, and somewhat in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. It's talked about a little bit more in the Bhagavatam. Krishna most of all talks about situating, I'm not going to get this exactly right, talks about raising the life air between the eyebrows and situating the mind in the heart. And I must confess that I'm not a Sat Chakra yogi. So I know something about the chakras. I have a friend who's, thank you, much more experienced, and I asked him about this. Why is Krishna talking about between the eyebrows, which is the Ajna Chakra, and the heart, the Anahata Chakra? And he gave me an answer, but I didn't memorize his answer. I'm sorry. But it is advised throughout the Bhagavad Gita to meditate on the Lord in the heart chakra. Although it's very interesting that many of our, in Bhakti Yoga, we are in what's called the Gaudiya school of Bhakti Yoga, and many of the teachers in our school say, rather than just meditating on Krishna in the heart chakra, one should meditate on Krishna in the spiritual world. So we're going to another realm here with that. But there is some discussion like that. But Krishna explains in a number of places that he is situated in the heart chakra of the living entity. And he also talks about raising the life air to the Ajna chakra. He talks about the Ajna more than the Sahasra. And Krishna also talks about how he joins with the life air to digest the foodstuff, which Srila Prabhupada says in his purports, Krishna is referring to the Manipur chakra around the navel. So he definitely talks about Sat Chakra Yoga. Now that's Satchaka Yoga is part of Dhyan Yoga. We talked about, right, four yogas: Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, Dhyan Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. So Satchaka Yoga is part of Dhyan Yoga. Now, though some of those things can be used in bhakti, like in bhakti one is going to act externally piously, like someone in Karma Yoga. One will study philosophy as someone in Gyan Yoga, and one certainly meditates as somebody in Dhyan Yoga. But we don't necessarily get into the detailed aspects of those practices. They're certainly genuine practices. Do keep in mind, though, that the chakras are part of the subtle or the astral body, which is also not the self. The self is beyond even the chakras and the astral body. The astral body with its chakras is a subtle covering of the self. So if one's using if one can use that, and I think a difference is that those in Dhyan Yoga or Astanga Yoga, they're using the gross and subtle bodies mechanically. The human body particularly is designed so that if you work with it mechanically in a certain way, it will put you into a state of Brahman or Paramatma realization, mechanically. And in fact, we could do that to some extent with all of you in about 15 or 20 minutes. It's not that difficult to at least touch that kind of thing. But because it's mechanical, there's a danger that it doesn't stay. The idea of Dhyan Yoga is you touch the truth mechanically, and you're supposed to get so attracted to the truth by touching it mechanically that you naturally give up your material attachments. But often it's people who, first of all, you have to be very qualified to do that process accurately. And second of all, it's very hard to stay there. Because you're staying there, how do I explain it? You're staying there by force of will. And you're trying to stay there by force of will long enough until the emotion kicks in and the desire kicks in. But you may not be able to. We're pleasure-seeking by nature, and if you're trying to stay in that place of realization until the emotion and desire kicked in through mechanical control of the senses and the mind, you may slip back into material enjoyment. Whereas in bhakti, we're trying to go from the beginning to a genuine attraction to the truth. And when you do it in that way, your chances of slipping down are less, at least once you get to a certain. Also, bhakti can be done by anybody. You can do bhakti even if you're now completely in the mode of ignorance. You can still start bhakti. You don't have to wait to follow those four principles to start bhakti. You can start bhakti even if you're breaking all four of those principles. You can. Even if you're breaking all four of them, you can still chant Hare Krishna. We don't say to people, you can't start chanting Hare Krishna until you're following all of these. Whereas Jnana Yoga is not like that. You have to do the yam and niyam first. You have to first come to the mode of goodness. You have to first be in sattva-gun before you're even going to get any effect of the pranayama and the asanas. I'm sorry, you know, all the people who teach these asanas and pranayama without first sattva-gun, I mean, they still have some benefit in regulating the heart and the blood pressure and that kind of thing, but they're not going to bring you to realization without being in sattva-gun first. I hope that's enough. There's more. I have a little experience with these things, but you really want to talk to somebody. I mean, I know many of our devotees who are much more experienced from this than me. Yes?
Oh, just a tiny question about touching on about what you were, your last answer. So you said you were just saying that the chakras are part of one's astral body, and I wasn't sure if that term is the same as the term that Prabhupada
the subtle
commonly
body.
Uses, the subtle body.
Yes.
And then if so, then are you referring to, does that refer to a certain part of the subtle body, which Bhagavad Gita refers to as mind intelligence and false ego.
I understand that as the whole thing.
The whole thing.
Yeah, mind intelligence and ego. That mind intelligence and ego, the structure of it, is dealing with the prana and the chakras and the nadis and the kundalini. I mean, Prabhupada doesn't talk about that kind of thing very often. I think he only has a couple references to kundalini in his books, for example. It's not something he talks about a lot. He talks about the chakras here and there. And I think the reason he doesn't talk about it a lot is that it's not an integral part of our bhakti yoga process, except for the general idea of meditating on the Lord in the heart. But as I say, most of our teachers, most of our acharyas, are not so much recommending that we meditate on the Lord in the heart, but they recommend that we meditate on the Lord in the spiritual world. Or Prabhupada will speak in a very general way. He'll say, you know, chanting Hare Krishna means that in your heart you imagine you have a diamond throne and Krishna's sitting on it and you're bathing him with water from the Ganges and the Jamuna and you're dressing him and you're decorating him with ornaments. And if you chant like that and meditate on Krishna, wherever you go becomes a holy place. But when Prabhupada's saying like that, you meditate that in your heart you've made a diamond throne for Krishna. He's not giving instructions on how to work with the prana and move the life air to the heart chakra. It's just not something the Prabhupada gives instructions on at all. It's not something that he talks about at all. Yes?
When you just said Prabhupada talks about meditating on Krishna in the spiritual world, can you give me an example of what that is like? How do you go about that?
Well, first you'd have to do the Chach Trinu. You'd have to hear about the spiritual world. Right. So you couldn't do that without some training. Because although you're meditating using the mind, and Prabhupada's using the word imagine, you know, that you're going to have to do some imagining and using the mind, still you want to imagine and use the mind according to what you've heard. On a material level, if you're going to go visit Paris and you've never been to Paris, but you've heard about it, you've seen pictures of it, and other people have talked to you about it, and you could imagine being in Paris even before you get there. But if you haven't heard anything about Paris, how are you going to do that? So it's going to be by hearing about it, and by hearing about it, one can then use the mind to think about and imagine Krishna in the spiritual world according to what we've heard about from the scriptures. And eventually what happens when you do that is that Krishna becomes interested and he actually reveals the spiritual world within us. Does that make some sense? Something like, you know, if you meet somebody over the internet, you're just talking to them, eventually they may show up at your door. They'll say, you know what, now I'd like to actually meet you. Right? It just happened to me the other day. Some people were coming to visit me where I was staying at their house. And they're on 102nd Road, not 102nd Avenue. So the people coming to see me, you know, their GPS took them to 102nd Avenue. So they call me up, you know, we're doing these things where we're talking to each other on the phone and we're going outside and eventually while we're talking to each other, all of a sudden we see each other. Yes? Something like that. So you're using the mind to meditate on Krishna in the spiritual world. You're using the mind, and all of a sudden then Krishna is there. Does that answer your question? Anything else? Okay, well, thank you very much.